We are in the book of Romans. It's an awesome book. I am excited to be going through this thing. I hope you guys are too. We have spent the last 2 weeks dealing with the introduction to Romans. And so what Paul does, Paul is the author of the letter, and he is writing this letter to the church in Rome. And he's writing this, and in the beginning of this letter is an introduction, like any typical letter will introduce, or any book will introduce what they're about to talk about, okay? And so Paul concludes this introduction with a summary of the introduction of the book, right? So the summary and the conclusion of the introduction is here in verses 16 and 17. Now, if you're freaking out and you're thinking like, how long are we going to be in Romans? Relax, because we're going to be here for a while. And it's not going to, and I promise you, it's not going to feel as long as you might think it's going to be. So just hang in there. We're going to take breaks in the middle, and it's going to be fun, okay? Paul continues specifically on the idea of being eager to preach the gospel. So if you're looking at chapter 1, verse 16, you just look a little bit back, verse 15. Again, if you're unfamiliar, the big numbers are chapters and the little numbers are verses, right? And so verse 15, Paul says that he's eager to preach the gospel. And so then you see the word for there at the beginning of verse 16. And for tells us that everything that he's going to that he's about to say in 16 is describing verse 15. So he's eager to preach the gospel. So why is he eager to preach the gospel? That's what we're going to talk about in just a minute, okay? The truth is that Paul's language here is so rich that we could take this book apart line by line. We could do two verses until Jesus comes back. Like literally, we could be in this book for like years, like 10 years, 20 years, but we're not. It's not going to be that long. It's going to be less than a year for sure. Which might not give any of you encouragement, but yeah, whatever. We've been doing our thing, so we're going to keep doing our thing. The reason why we are only doing two verses, though, today is because of the reality that these two verses present some very clear and dominant themes that are in the letter. And so some people even say that these two verses are a summary of the whole book of Romans. And so if you're one of those guys who always wants a shortcut and is always trying to get to the end really quick, man, learn these two verses and you might get a pretty good idea of what Paul talks about in the rest of the letter. Okay, so let's read these two verses. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So Paul makes this point here. Jew first and Greek. I'm going to comment on it now because we're not going to really hit it in our outline. But Paul makes this point again that the gospel can save people of any ethnicity. And that's one of the tensions that he's going to deal with in the rest of the book. Because there's this big beef between Jew and Gentile. So Jews are guys who are born Jews, like that's an ethnicity. And then Gentile is anyone that's not Jew. So if you're in the room today and you're not a Jew, and you should know, if you don't know you're not a Jew, you're not a Jew. Right? You know what I mean? Or if you don't know you're a Jew, you're not a Jew, okay? Because you probably would know. Like, I know I'm Japanese. Like, I've been told from the day I was born that I'm Japanese. Everywhere I look, I go to parties, it's Japanese parties. You know what I mean? That's all we do, okay? So, you would know. But there's this big tension between Jew and Gentile in the book of Romans. And what Paul does is he tries to use the gospel as a platform to get them to reconcile with one another. Pointing to the fact that Christians have been reconciled with God. And in that same line and in the same kind of thinking that we should be reconciled to people who are different from us. Verse 17, for in the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. All right, so it seems like pretty simple or whatever, but there's a lot happening here. Here's the main idea that I hope we walk out with this morning. We should live unashamedly confident in the gospel. Paul begins by saying that he is not ashamed of the gospel, right? For I am not ashamed of the gospel in verse 16. Christians likely lack size. At this time in history, Christians probably lack size, fame, and honor in the Roman world. Christians might be tempted to be ashamed of the gospel because they're many times persecuted for the gospel, for being Christians. In our increasingly non-Christian world, a biblical worldview is becoming increasingly unpopular. Biblical thinking on issues regarding gender, abortion, marriage, parenting, all are becoming more and more unpopular in the world. And if we just even say it in common conversation, sometimes we can get smashed for it, or people try to smash us for it. In the face of opposition, Paul makes clear that he is not ashamed of the gospel. Paul is focused on the gospel as a main point here in his letter and in his ministry. That's what we're going to see throughout this whole book, the gospel. We saw it all the way already throughout the entire introduction. So if you just read the first chapter, you can see gospel, gospel, gospel all over this thing. Paul is focused on the gospel as a main point. As Paul concludes his greeting that we have already seen loaded with references to the gospel, we see in his conclusion three specific aspects of the gospel that he introduces that we're going to see in further breakdown as we continue in the letter from chapters 2 to 16. There's 16 chapters in this book. But these three themes are all here in these two verses. And try to see it. You can just read the text over and over again as I'm talking. But these three themes are these: salvation, righteousness, and faith. Three huge themes in these two small verses that are also echoed in the rest of the letter. Before we move on, I want to talk about the gospel, okay? So what is the gospel? The gospel is good news. It literally translates as good news. It's good news in the face of the worst news. See, the worst news is that we are condemned to hell. Apart from Jesus, we have no hope. All of us, everyone in this room. Apart from Jesus, that's where we were heading. The good news, though, is that Jesus comes, lives, dies, and rises from the grave, paying for our sin and giving us everlasting life. Eternal separation from God is a huge problem. The only solution possible, the only power that can fix this problem of being separated from God is the gospel. The gospel is the power of God. Note that that's in the text there. That gives individuals the righteousness of God. That's also in the text there. No longer unrighteous because of our sin, we are made righteous because of the work of Jesus. Not because of anything that we do, no matter how good we are or we think we are. As the good news of Jesus is proclaimed, God gives us faith to believe. This faith gives us the righteousness of God as our sins are forgiven. Once we are declared righteous, we continue to live our lives in faith, learning to obey, submit to, and trust Jesus more and more every day until we die. The gospel is the good news that death in this life is not an end, but instead it's a beginning of eternity with Jesus for the believer. The gospel is the good news that instead of an eternal death separated from God, we can now be reconciled to Him and spend eternity with Him in the afterlife, in heaven. As we handle the rest of verses 16 and 17, we'll look closer as to why we should be unashamed of the gospel. So the first reason why we should be unashamed of the gospel is because the gospel is God's power to save. It's there in verse 16. For it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. Let's think about God's power for a second here. God's power has been clear since the Old Testament. Exodus chapter 9 verse 16 says this. Don't turn there. It should be on the screen. But for this purpose, I have raised you up to show you my power so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. In this passage, God is talking to Moses. God raises up Moses and he delivers the Israelites. If you don't know this story, there's been a couple movies like The Prince of Egypt. That's one. But it's a whole story where Moses is over there and then the Israelites are enslaved by the Egyptians and then they run away from Pharaoh and then they finally get to the Red Sea and then God parts the Red Sea and then there's whales in the Red Sea and all of that, right? You guys seen those movies, right? Now, that's power, right? God did this work. God delivered the Israelites. God repeatedly did this work throughout all of the Old Testament. Here's another example, Psalm 77, the psalmist records this. You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. You, with your arm, redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. God works wonders. God redeemed his people over and over again. I mean, we could spend hours just pulling up scriptures like this, but we can see how God's power was demonstrated all throughout the Old Testament. The second observation that we can make regarding God's power is that God's power saves everyone who believes. It says, to everyone who believes. The idea of belief and faith are repeated and key in Paul's letter to the Romans. Saving faith is more than what we know about God and the gospel. We are saved when the gospel is made known to us and we respond to this gospel in full faith, putting our trust in Jesus and in no one or nothing else. While believing is not something we do, we also must understand that believing and salvation to be completely passive for individuals. We must not understand believing and salvation to be completely passive in individuals. Let me say that one more time. Believing is not something that we do. We can't just all of a sudden wake up one day and say, you know what, I just believe on my own merit. We're given faith by God so that we can believe. But at the same time, we cannot be at this point where like, I don't do anything and I just sit here and all of a sudden it all magically happens. That doesn't work either. Why? Because we can read and we're going to study in Romans time and time again how Paul criticizes and puts fault on people for their unbelief. And so it's in their court. Their unbelief is a reason. They're responsible for their unbelief. It's not God's fault that they don't believe. Okay, and there's something we'll wrestle with. It's a huge discussion. And so if you're uncomfortable, just relax. We're going to get to it in the rest of Romans, okay? And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, don't worry. We're going to get to it, especially in Romans chapter 8 and 9. And so you definitely want to come back when we hit those passages. All right. The gospel saves people from sin. Like, that's the point here. That's what we should know, and that's what we should take out of this room. That the gospel saves people from their sin. That's what Paul's saying there in that first sentence. See, we should be clear that the gospel is the power of God. We might better understand God's power as we see it active in other examples. In the Old Testament, when God parted the Red Sea so Moses and Israel could escape slavery, we can clearly see God's power, right? The sea split, right? When we consider creation and the fact that God created the sun, we should be able to tangibly feel God's power, right? So if you live in Hawaii any amount of time, you know that when the summer months hit and it gets really hot, and if you don't have air conditioning, like, you're hating the sun. And the power of the sun is just like unbearably in front of you, right? Like, it is powerful because you're so hot that you get angry, right? Like, I don't even know how that works. Like, it's hot and you get angry, something like that. If you don't know, if you're like new here or like, you know, you're visiting the island, you'd be like, oh, I love the sun. I just live here for like 20 years and then see what happens. And then sit in traffic for 2 hours in the sun and then see how you feel about that. But the power of God is evident, right? For the believer and non-believer, we might sometimes not fully understand and remember the power of God. We are all born sinners, separated from God. This truth means that despite our best effort, being nice people, taking care of the environment, excelling in our career, these works cannot save us. Though we always think that they do, right? That's why we strive to be so good so many times and so often, even for believers. But we have to be reminded is that the Bible says that that doesn't save us. What saves us? It's in verse 16. The gospel is the power of God. Only God can save us from our sin. Only God has the power to pay the debt that we owe because of sin. The gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. See, men accomplish many great things, right? We often celebrate the human spirit. These celebrations are often powerful moments. Athletes defying odds to become the best in their sport. People who serve in the military. Moms, dads who work 2, sometimes 3 jobs to provide for their families. People who go on America's Got Talent and shock everyone with their skills. Did you guys see that video of that like 13-year-old girl who sang? I thought that was super cool. Like, she's like an opera singer and it was on Facebook. It's not like I'm into America's Got Talent. I mean, and if you're into America's Got Talent, no worry. But Bruce is looking at me like, why are you watching America's Got Talent? I'm like, don't worry, bro. I'm okay. It's on Facebook and I was curious. So, anyways, I forgot. Our culture celebrates these people. As powerful and as many times good as these people are. Like, I'm not trying to take away from them. Like, what they do is good, right? But these moments, these people are nothing compared to the gospel. But yet, how much do we celebrate the gospel? Like we can watch these videos online or whatever, and we can start to cry or whatever, tear up and become emotional. But does the gospel make you emotional like that? Do you understand that the power of God is in the gospel? And it's, if you know it, and if you've heard it, if you're familiar with it, if you're saved by it, man, you should feel like that all the time. We should. We should be eager to sing songs about the gospel. That's why we sing songs about the gospel. We should be eager to hear the gospel. God's power saves man from sin. Let's move on. Verse 17, as we're going to now unpack either how or why. Like, my grammar is like horrible. And most people say that it's why. That this next sentence answers why the gospel saves us, or why it's the power of God. But I think it's also how. So you can figure that out as we go through this. The gospel makes us righteous. Verse 17. The gospel is God's saving power because the final revelation of God's saving righteousness is unveiled in the gospel. The righteousness of God saves. Let's talk about this righteousness of God. This righteousness of God that is imputed to us, that is given to us as believers. The righteousness of God saves. The righteousness of God is revealed in the gospel and is made known to the individual. As the gospel is proclaimed, the righteousness of God is manifested in the believer. People are changed when they hear and receive the gospel. People are changed from being condemned sinners to being redeemed believers and followers of Jesus. The righteousness of God is a positional status that is assigned to individuals because of God, not because of themselves. So here's a question. As we apply this and as we think about this in our lives, what I want us to think about is, why is it important to understand our positional righteousness before God? Paul's letter and the rest of the Bible is clear that our positional righteousness has nothing to do with us. God saves us from our sin. God makes us right before Him by His power and by His choice. This is great news because this frees us from the burden that we often have, that we often put on ourselves or that to perform, that we often put on ourselves to perform. Whether it's to be kind, to love others, to forgive, to avoid bad habits. A clear understanding that God changes our status from sinner to saint should free us from the bondage of performing for God. We should understand that we cannot perform for God. No matter how hard we try, no matter how much we try to get better and better and better, we're always going to fall short. But this positional righteousness that God gives us, that Paul is talking about in this verse, is a righteousness that gives us, that should give us assurance that even when we fail, God is there to make up the gap and make up the difference. And that we don't need to kill ourselves trying to be perfect individuals, because it's God who makes up the difference. Our failures should only remind us that God has forgiven us of our sin. And so when we fail and when we sin and when God reveals Himself to us and we know that we've sinned, what that should do for us is remind us that God is awesome and that He saved us in it. Our pain and suffering should remind us that God will one day fully deliver us from our pain and suffering. See, this positional righteousness means no matter how painful life gets, no matter what happens, whether it's death, whether it's terminal illness, well, I guess that's the same thing, whether it's like losing the ability to move or walk, whether it's a relational dysfunction, whether it's whatever it is that we face in our life, this positional righteousness means that after this life, no matter how we stumble through it, we have this thing waiting us at the end of our lives, which is eternity with God, perfection, heaven. Despite how bad things get on earth, God changing our status before it means that we have hope, not dependent on us, not dependent on our performance or the situation we face in life. Our hope is in a perfect God who, in His perfection, has chosen to make us right before Him. And so this positional righteousness that Paul is talking about here is huge. It's not just some theological idea, but once we understand it and get it, it should change how we live the rest of our lives. The righteousness of God also, though, transforms. Those that God vindicates, God also changes. God's righteousness is in a sense given to believers, but is also in a sense growing as we mature as believers. Throughout the Old Testament, we see repeatedly the word righteousness used as an active process. Here are a couple examples. I hope you can see it, but if not, this is the simplest way we can communicate it. A very complicated theological idea. So Isaiah 46 says it like this: I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off. And my salvation will not delay. I put my salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. Psalm 98 verse 2 says this: the Lord has made known his salvation. He has revealed his righteousness in the sight of the nations. He has remembered his steadfast love and his faithfulness to the house of Israel. All the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. Verse 2 there should be on screen. We see righteousness is revealed. And then in verse 3, we see the author point the reader to God's saving promises and active work in the house of Israel. Paul concludes by connecting righteousness and faith together. And that's what you see in the last part of verse 17. We just unpacked the idea that we receive a righteousness based not on our works, but based on God and his works. The reality is that we continue to live lives affected by sin. Our lives are not righteous like God's. We're never going to be righteous like God is. Well, exactly like God is. But that's what we strive for. That's what we live by faith for, right? The gospel gives us faith. And this is where faith comes in. The gospel gives us faith. Faith, first of all, is given by God. Paul is making the point when he says, from faith for faith, that faith alone can put us in right standing with God. It is by faith that we believe. It is from God that we receive faith. It is through faith that we receive the righteousness of God. Faith is a critical and required component in the salvation of men. It is by God's power and the proclamation of the gospel that faith is realized in people. This is an idea that Paul introduces here, but explains repeatedly and more fully throughout this letter. All of these ideas, he's just introducing it, okay? And so you're kind of getting it at a glance, and then we're going to cover it in the rest of the book. And so just keep coming back, please. Romans chapter 3, 22, Paul talks about righteousness. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Romans 3:28 says it like this: for we hold that one is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. Romans 4 says it this way: for the promise to Abraham and his offspring that he would be heir of the world did not come through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. So there's this connection between righteousness, the righteousness of God that we get, and faith that we live by, that we're given and that we live by, right? And so Paul is trying to connect the two. As we continue to look at faith, we should understand that faith is how we should live every day. Paul further explores the idea of faith as he quotes Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4. And if you're with us earlier this year, we talked about Habakkuk, but I'll remind us. Paul quotes Habakkuk, emphasizing the importance of faith. See, Habakkuk makes a point that faith is central to the relationship with God. That's what Habakkuk says in chapter 2. In Habakkuk chapter 2. In what he wrote, right? In the midst of a nation that is supposed to worship God, not doing so. That's what Habakkuk is living in. So Habakkuk is a man of God, and someone from Judah. And Judah is supposed to be people who are following God. But these people who are supposed to be following God isn't following God anymore. And so Habakkuk complains to God and says, God, why aren't these people following you anymore? In the midst of God judging his own people by allowing a more wicked nation to run them over. If you read Habakkuk, that's the second thing that happens. God does answer Habakkuk's complaint, but the way that he answers them is by allowing a more wicked nation to run them over. When God should have just been probably preserving them or making them better or correcting them, what he does is he allows them to get run over. In the midst of this turmoil that Habakkuk is living in, which is where you get this quote from, Habakkuk's conclusion was to still live by faith. to still have absolute reliance on God in the midst of complete turmoil, in the midst of a world where he doesn't understand God. He doesn't understand the political landscape. He doesn't understand the war that they're in. He doesn't understand the abuse that they're facing. He doesn't understand people's rebellion to God. He doesn't understand a lot of things in the world. Sound a little bit familiar, right? Paul, though, is making the same point on this level. The righteousness of God is manifested in God's people as God's people believe and have faith in him. As God reveals himself to his people, the power of the gospel enables God's people to have faith. This is the faith that God's people should live with every day. We should live absolutely reliant on God every day, even in the midst of absolutely uncertain times. In every situation and circumstance, God's people should rely on him. And so the question before us at this point is, are you completely reliant on God every day in every situation? Are you reliant on God in the small things? Are you thankful and reliant on God for the food that you eat, the transportation that you use, a roof over your head? Are you reliant on God for those things, or do you take it for granted? Are you thankful and reliant to God for the breath of life? Do you wake up and be like, man, I rely on you to breathe right now? Or do we just do it? Are you reliant on God in the mundane things of life? Driving to work, performing tasks at work, getting ready in the morning, brushing your teeth, putting on clothes, hanging out with friends or family? Are you reliant on God in the challenges of life? When you face challenges, do you simply just put your head down and push through? I just talked to a guy last night, like, his world is falling apart. He's like, nah, but I just couldn't keep going. I'm like, okay, fun. Sometimes God allows challenges in our lives to force us to be reliant on him. See, that's where that guy is missing it. Like, you can learn how to be reliant on God. Something that would carry you into eternity. Give you forgiveness of sin, salvation. Expose you to the righteousness of God, the power of God. So what do? Are you relying on God, or are you relying on yourself? A life lived by faith is a life lived completely reliant on God in financial challenges, in health challenges, in relational challenges. We're saved through faith, and we should also live by faith. The gospel is not only good news that gives us the righteousness of God, but the gospel gives us faith to live the rest of our lives as we are made more and more like the image of God. I'm going to wrap it up with a couple stories here. Most of us are, or illustrations at least, most of us are reliant on our cell phones, right? We use our phones for function, coordinating, maybe work, planning, communication, maybe emergencies. We use our phones for also entertainment, right? Watching shows, communicating with friends, playing games. We always know where our phones are, or at least I do. When we lose our phones, our life stops, right? How many of you lose your phone? Everything stops. Like, you looking in the car, you're throwing everything upside down, you're blaming everybody. Well, you touch my phone. Kids, you're playing games again. I told you, put it back after you use it, right? And then really, I was the one who just put it someplace and left it there. It's one of the first things many of us think about or interact with when we wake up. And it's the last thing we interact with when we go to sleep. I mean, how many of you guys did that right now? How many of you guys been on your phone? I mean, I know you got your Bible right on your phone, so. But you're still reliant on it, is my point. We're completely reliant on our phones. Some of us are. I know some of you guys are like good Christians. You're like, no, I put it away. I come home and spend time with my family and I read the Bible. Like, okay, I get it. I get it. You guys are good, but still not good enough to forgive your sins, though. Here's the point, is we should be relying on the gospel. As followers of Jesus, we should be completely reliant on the gospel. The gospel affects every aspect of Christian life. The gospel is the power of God to save and for life every day as believers. Do you think about the gospel as much as you think about or interact with your phone? Is the gospel at the center of your life? Do you think about the gospel in the small, mundane things of life? Do you think about the gospel as you make decisions? Do you consider the gospel as you interact with other people? As followers of Jesus, we should think about and consider the grace of God as we are allowed opportunities to show grace. When people irritate us, we should think about the gospel. You know why? Because we irritate God. Our sin irritates God. I mean, to say the least. I mean, our sin is horribly offensive to God. And so not only do we irritate God, but it's horribly offensive. People who are less fortunate. People who hurt us. Our sin hurts God. Our sin is, we are less fortunate compared to a holy and righteous and perfect God. As followers of Jesus, we should think about the sacrifice of Jesus as we're allowed opportunities to live generous lives. We think about, like we talk about every week as we give, that we should be generous in our finances, in our time, in our talent, with our talents. We should be generous in our lives, not always trying to control and protect and create these boundaries, but we should be generous in every aspect of our lives. As followers of Jesus, we should consider the holiness of God as we consider our lives. We should strive for lives of holiness because we serve and have been saved by a holy God. And so we should live holy lives. One last illustration, and then you can come up, and then we should kind of move quickly. We're going to take communion this morning, that's why. I am often highly motivated to do things or have things, right? For about six, let me give you one example of my big motivation, I don't know how you say it, being highly motivated. For about 6 months, I knew we were coming to a place where we might be needing a bigger house. Because if you're part of this church, you know that we do all the meetings at our house, right? We do fights at our house. I mean, like, we watch fights at our house, and we might do fights at our house one day. It might not be. I'm not volunteering for that, but we might. Because I know how guys can fight in this church, so I don't want to fight any of them. Our meetings and chill times are always, we're getting full at our old apartment. We had a townhouse. And I mean, it's good size. It was really good for us, but it's getting full because you guys are doing a great job of inviting friends and family, and God's growing the church, and it's awesome, right? So it's getting full, and I knew it would be good to have a garage and a backyard. So the result of this problem or situation was that I was highly motivated to find the right deal, right? And so I was literally on Craigslist every single day for like 6 months, every day, looking, and every time I knew every house that was for rent in IAEA, at least I was on Craigslist. And I could tell you, and I drove by almost all of them, or the ones that kind of met what we were looking for. The house that we're in now went online and was online for less than 24 hours. I was the first one to call. I called around 9 p.m. one night. I made appointment for 11 a.m. the next morning. And in that short amount of time, five other people jumped on my meeting. And so I got there, and there's like five other people for my showing. I was like, oh, there's no way we're going to get this thing. Obviously we got it, right? But then, but I was highly motivated. So I was calling. So I even when we went to the showing, I was like, so if there's any way that we can get this house, tell me what we can do. And then the guy actually said, oh, if you buy a washer dryer, I'll give you the place. I was like, shoot, so I'll buy a washer dryer. And then, but we worked out a deal. I mean, we're going to prorate it. Like, if we're only there for a year, then, you know what I mean, we're not really buying it. So it's a really good deal. And so we got the place. But I was highly motivated. So the guy could have said almost anything. Like, oh, I need you to redo all the electrical. I was like, oh, we got that. Easy. Guaranteed. I know a guy who can do that electrical work. Right? You know what I mean? So anything. And because I was highly motivated. Whether it's, we are all highly motivated at different points in our lives. Whether it's a house, a hobby, a car, a new toy, an upcoming trip, a TV series. Hey, Peaky Blinders just came out. Don't ask me where I'm at in the series. It's embarrassing. We all know what it is to be motivated by something. Paul is motivated by the gospel, though. That's what he is. Like, look at this introduction. Look at this book. He's motivated by the gospel. Paul is saved. He's called to be an apostle. He's set apart for the gospel. That's Romans 1:1. Look, it's right there, right in front of you. Paul is thankful and prayerful for the gospel. That's Romans 8:15. We just talked about it last week. Paul is eager to preach the gospel. That's Romans 1:8-15 is thankful and prayerful. Romans 1:15 is he's eager to preach the gospel. Paul is motivated. And all of it lands here on verses 16 and 17. The ending point of the introduction is here in verses 16 and 17. Paul is motivated because the gospel is the power of God for salvation. It gives us God's righteousness, and the gospel gives us faith. The proclamation of the gospel does these things. We gain it because of the gospel. And if you don't understand the gospel, keep coming. We talk about it every week. And it takes time to fully understand it. But it's the gospel that will save you. And it's when you understand this, it's when God opens your eyes for you to understand this, you're given this faith and you live this life that's completely different. And if it hasn't happened to you yet, don't worry. Just keep coming. Nobody's judging. There's no time clock on this thing. We have no control of when it happens. But when it happens, you're going to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that God is real and that he saved you from your sin. And in that moment, we rejoice. And it's happening over and over again, time and time again here in this church and all around us. Why? Because we know a lot of people who don't know the gospel. And so every time we're talking to people, it's coming alive in people's life. And when it comes alive, we know it. Because it's the power of God, and the power of God is undeniable. And so I pray that we might be secure in this positional righteousness that we have gained because of God, not because of ourselves. All right, that's my time. We're going to transition right into communion. So if what you guys can do is, why don't you guys come up and grab the elements. Communion, let me explain communion real quick. So communion is a sacrament. It's a ceremony that's described in the Bible. And so Jesus did this with his disciples, and he instructed the new church to do it. And what it is, it's remembering the sacrifice that Jesus made when he died on the cross for our sins. And so the bread is representative of the body that was broken, and the wine or the juice is representative of the blood that was shed. Now, if you're not a Christian here, I want to invite you to feel absolute no shame in not participating, because if you participate, what that is, I mean, I guess you're welcome to, but all you're doing is eating bread and drinking juice, just like giving, right? If you're just making a donation, it's the same thing. If you're a believer, I invite you to participate, and I invite you to remember the sacrifice that Jesus made, and to do it humbly and in an attitude of repentance, asking God for forgiveness. So as your conscience, as you feel like, go ahead and grab the juice or the wine, and then everybody grab a piece of bread. It's, we got our, what you call them? Annie's. We got Annie's. So you guys can, grab it, go back to your seat, stand up. We're going to sing a song, and then we're going to take it together. That's what